The word medieval is simply an adjective that means middle. And so this is the way that periodization usually goes in church history. There's the classical period, and then the middle, and then the modern. And the classical period runs up to about 500 AD. And then from 500 to 1000, we usually call that the early Middle Ages, and 1000 to 1500, the late Middle Ages. And at that basic time when the Reformation comes in, that's when modern church history starts. These obviously are arbitrary dates, but they do help us by giving us some general framework for discussion. So we're looking at this middle period, and let's get my stuff back in order here. What we're going to be looking at today are some of the events that impacted the medieval church. So we're going to be looking at some political developments that are very important. And we start out with the Roman Empire and talking about the fall of the Roman Empire in the West. Now, I say in the West because the Roman Empire continued in a Byzantine form for really about another 1,000 years in the East, until finally Constantinople fell in around 1453 AD, I think, with the Ottoman Turks. But we're talking about the West, and while there certainly were things going on in other parts of the world, our attention is going to be directed toward Western civilization, European history, and the church in that particular part of the world. The Roman Empire fell, but it didn't fall with a thud. It kind of disintegrated and decayed in bits and pieces. And there's always been this question, why the fall of the Roman Empire? And it's a question that's fascinated historians, but there really is no one cause. A combination of factors could be cited, such as the decision to move the seat of the empire from Rome to Constantinople. That was done by a guy named Constantine. He decided to name the city after himself. It's present-day Istanbul. So administrative moves like that sort of weakened things a bit. There was certainly some imperial and administrative incompetence. They had monetary problems. They had military problems. But there was a moral decadence that set in after a while. You know, just to talk about Rome in general, it had its legendary beginning back in 700s BC with the two twins Romulus and Remus being nursed by a she-wolf. I don't think that really happened. But that's the legendary beginnings of Rome, these seven little hills, the villages that developed there, forming into Rome, and then by bits and pieces over the centuries, you have all of this development, all of this conquering. And if you flip your outline over, it's not the greatest map, but it'll help us a little bit. At its height, the Roman Empire stretched from Great Britain in the northwest all the way to the borders of Persia, present-day Iran, the southeast, covered all of North Africa, the northern part of North Africa. And then where you see that white area at the top, and then this line here, that's the east-west flow of the Danube River and the north-south flow of the Rhine River, forming a natural boundary. And that's kind of the limits of the extent of the Roman Empire at its height. It was so vast that the Mediterranean Sea was at times referred to as the Roman Lake. Well, Rome began to fall on some hard times after a while, and it began to decline. Gibbon's work, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. It led people to wonder, why is this happening? And that really, I think, leads us to talk just for a moment about a very significant person, Augustine of Hippo. He was a bishop in the late 4th and early 5th centuries A.D., and he is the most significant Christian between the Apostle Paul and Martin Luther. Augustine, coming as he did at this hinge period between late antiquity, the late classical period, and the beginning of the middle period, serves as a hinge figure. And he interpreted, to a great extent, the church to the Middle Ages and leaves an impact that is so strong that even Martin Luther was an Augustinian monk, by the way. And you can't underestimate, can't overestimate, whatever. You can't prize Augustine's influence too highly. Now, he was living at this period of time when Rome is disintegrating, and the question was asked, well, why is this happening? And some of the older pagan Roman religionists, they still existed at the time, they thought that the reason that Rome was falling on hard times was because she had abandoned the old pagan gods that had made her great. And especially this upstart religion, Christianity, had contributed to the downfall of Rome. And it's because of Rome's apostasy from the gods that made her great. Of course, Augustine disagreed with that. And he had a philosophy of history that's contained in one of his most important works. It was written around this early 5th century time. And that work was called City of God. Exactly. Very good. And in the City of God, his philosophy of history, Augustine has a few presuppositions that undergird the work. One of them was he believed in a radically fallen humanity. He believed that man was inherently sinful, and it was in Adam's fall we sinned all. He did not believe in the inherent goodness of man. He also believed that God is a sovereign, predestinating God, and that he is in charge of everything, not just things having to do with religion, but everything. So he sets up kings and he deposes kings. Augustine also believed that the church was not completely good and the world was not completely bad. He believed that pagans were able to display some virtues and that Christians were able to display some sins. And he actually died in 430 A.D. in his town of Hippo while the pagan tribe, the barbarian tribe, the Vandals, were besieging the walls of the city. So in writing this work, why is God letting this happen? He said Rome's calamities were the result of her own crimes. What are great empires without justice, if not robbery on a grand scale? Every empire, he said, deserves destruction because dominated by the lust for power. And it's no more moral when rising than when falling. But God, according to his sovereign will, allows empires to rise through a blending on their part of self-discipline and arrogance, only to bring them down in his own good time. That was his take. Paul, I think, said something similar in Acts 17 in his famous sermon on Mars Hill, speaking to the men of Athens. He said, "The God who made the world and everything in it," this is Acts 17:24, "being Lord of heaven and earth," there you have a sovereign predestinating God, or a sovereign God, does not live in temples, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God in the hope that they might feel after him and find him, though he is not far from any of them. He made of one blood all the nations of men to dwell on the face of the earth, and he has determined the times before appointed and the bounds of their habitations. So you have wars. You have upheavals. You have changing boundaries. And that although these things are the are caused by the actions of sinful men, God stands behind all that's going on, and He's appointed these different boundaries. And He does it for a purpose, so that men might seek after Him and find Him. Because what is it that upheavals and wars and crises and sufferings, what is it that they do to us? They make us cry out to God for mercy and help. They can also have the effect of hardening and embittering people as well. But God has a purpose in all of these things. And that is Augustine's, that's Paul's take on it, but this is also what Augustine is saying, that God is behind all these things, and He's appointed these boundaries. He's allotted these certain portions of time. So He'll allow kingdoms to rise, and then He'll bring them down in His own good time. Well, that was Augustine's take in the City of God. And I think he's on the right track for sure. But if we look a little bit more at some of the human causes, there was a gradual decay from corruption that occurred in Rome. There was an internal decay. There was an internal corruption. They were so prosperous and so successful for so long that they got soft, moral decadence, a lot of immorality, a lot of laziness on the part of the people. No longer were they fighting the wars, but they're hiring mercenaries to do the fighting. That had a corrupting influence on the loyalty of the soldiers to Rome. Eventually, some of these soldiers and their armies appoint their own generals to be in charge, and you find this kind of breakdown. I mentioned the transfer of the seat of power from Rome to Constantinople. This weakened the West. The East continued to be strengthened for a longer period of time. And then these northern borders, again, if you look at that map, stretching from the North Sea in the northwest to the Black Sea in the southeast, this had been a natural northern border for many, many years. From the time of Augustus, for 350 years, this had been the case. 14 legions of highly trained soldiers, supplemented by auxiliaries, almost 200,000 men, bordered this northern area. If you saw the movie The Gladiator, remember, it starts out with Maximus and the Roman legions, and then on the northern borders, all these fierce-looking German barbarians. And, you know, they send the messenger back. Well, they don't really send the messenger back. They send him part of him back. He doesn't have a head anymore, you know, and you get this feeling like, whoa, man, what's going on here? Well, that's a, you know, those things certainly did happen. That's not the entire story, but you've got this border region, and you've got these barbarian tribes. In 476, the last emperor in the West, Romulus Augustulus, was defeated by a Germanic chieftain, Odoacer, and that was taken as the symbolic end of the Roman Empire. However, it's a little bit too precipitous to say it happened quite like that. And that brings us to Roman numeral 2, the migration and invasion of barbarian tribes. A word about this word barbarian. The Greek word barbarous, originally used by the Greeks to describe anybody that wasn't a Greek. Kind of like how the Jews feel about the Gentiles. Well, this is how the Greeks felt about everybody else. If you're not Greek, you're a barbarian. Which meant you were uncivilized. Literally, it means I can't understand you, and you can't understand me. But the real problem is, I can't understand you because there's something wrong with you. You're inferior. Well, the Romans take this over, and in the way we're using the word, the Romans use this term barbarian to refer to foreigners on the northern borders, namely the Germanic tribes that invaded the Roman Empire. Now, I have to say something a little bit more about the Roman Empire at this time. I talked about how it was founded and how it grew, but it's a very significant thing because it was into the world of the Roman Empire that our Savior came. And it was into the world of the Roman Empire that Christianity developed and spread. And it spread for a very good reason. God, very wise, sent forth His Son in the fullness of time. He sent forth His Son, made of a woman, made under the law, to redeem them that are under the law. Paul tells us this in Galatians 4:4. What was significant about that time? Well, Rome was able to bring a degree of civilization and peace, Pax Romana, through power and force that brought stability to an ancient world that had never had it quite like that before. It brought with it a transportation system, the Roman roads. It brought with it a monolithic law. There was one law for all Roman citizens, even though they were a small percentage of the population. They all lived under the same law. It enabled there to be travel like never before. There was communication because there was one language. The Greek language was used throughout the empire. And so when our Lord came and when the church began, it was able to spread like wildfire because of this. But there was a problem. The church, after a while, was seen as a rival. There is another king, one Jesus. Ooh, that's not good. And that's why there was persecution. It wasn't because the Christians said Jesus is Lord. You could say He's Lord all you want. You just have to say that Caesar is Lord. And He's a more important Lord than Jesus. The Christians couldn't do that. And so they were persecuted as a result of that. Now, the Christian church was persecuted for a long period of time, well over 200 years. It was illegal to be a Christian. Persecution would ebb and flow. There were these things called imperial persecutions. I think there were seven of them in all. The last and the greatest of the imperial persecutions was the Diocletian persecution, and it was from about 300 to 310 AD. During that decade, thousands and thousands of Christians suffered in various ways, many of them with their own lives, and brutal and ghastly forms of execution were devised to put Christians to death. It was a very terrible persecution. It ended when a certain general came on the scene and defeated the other general, and the edicts of toleration occurred, Edict of Milan in particular, and Christianity went from a persecuted status to a favored status, and the general who became the emperor was Constantine the Great. Constantine the Great. Constantine, as I said, favored Christianity, although it didn't become the official state religion until the end of the 4th century. But his support and favor of Christianity was a mixed bag. It ended up beginning to be this merger of church and state with regard to Christianity, which is continues to still be an issue. Now, as time goes on, and I'm just giving you a little background here because it will help us in our understanding of what is taking place. During this period of time, the northern border is somewhat of a semi-permeable membrane. There is back and forth going on. These German tribes exist up there. They're really not allowed to officially come in. However, there is a lot of back and forth, and yet something happened in the middle part of the 4th century that changed all that. Coming from much farther east, the central plains of Asia were a really fierce group of people. If you thought the barbarians were fierce, well, these guys were really fierce. They were the Huns. And the most famous name among them, of course, is Attila. They also had the use of horses, and it was around this time that they developed something called a stirrup. And the stirrup makes it possible for you to make a horse into an agent of war, because now you can really direct him and you can use a weapon while you're on your horse, and that was a real advantage for the Huns. When they moved and pressed westward, they put such pressure on the German tribes on this northern border that some of these tribes appealed to the emperor and pressed to come across the border and to come in, and they did. And so that changed the calculus. The German tribes on the northern border, there had been migrations going on for several hundred years. Many of them come down from the north, and they were generally called Goths, G-O-T-H, Goths. Not the teenagers with black fingernails that hang out in shopping malls, but these are German tribes, okay? The real Goths. And they're generally divided into the Eastern Goths, which were the Ostrogoths, the Western Goths, the Visigoths, and then there were several tribes that made them up. But generally speaking, what was going on is the Huns overran the Ostrogoths in the east around the Black Sea and were putting real pressure on the Visigoths further west. Visigoths come into the empire and they begin to cause problems. The Visigoths end up going on a very long and interesting migration that takes them all over southern Europe, eventually ending up in the Iberian Peninsula in present-day Spain. But along the way, they dip down into Italy and they sack the city of Rome in 410 AD. The Visigoth chieftain Alaric defeats the eternal city. And that was considered just unthinkable. This is the news that spreads throughout the empire and is going, what in the world is going on? And it's what prompted Augustine and others to come up with, you know, why is this taking place? By the way, the two questions, among others, that Augustine tried to answer in City of God was, why is God letting this happen? And the other question was, is it appropriate to resist the barbarians? And his answer to that was, yes. And there's a funny anecdote about a general, I think his name was Boniface, that became a Christian during this time. And because he became a Christian, he wanted to turn away from being a soldier and enter the monastic life, and he asked Augustine about it, and Augustine's response was, good God, man, not now. So he wanted a little help there. And anyway, back to the outline. You probably have yours at hand a little better than I do. Okay, the movement of the Goths, they're putting pressure on Rome. And they are sacking and they're pillaging and these sorts of things are going on. But again, it's not the kind of precipitous, all flaming arrows and hacking and whacking. And, you know, some of that certainly was going on. But as Roland Bainton put it, and Roland Bainton is a Yale historian that he wrote in the 50s and 60s mainly. He said the so-called, this is a quote from him, the so-called barbarian invasion really constituted the breakdown of controlled immigration. Well, that's interesting. This is not a Fox News commentator. This is a 1950s Yale historian. There was just this back and forth. There was trade going on a lot, but there was still this feeling like, you guys are barbarians. We don't really like you, but sometimes we need you. As a matter of fact, would you like to come in and become our soldiers? But they felt like kind of second-class citizens. So, you know, there's the barbarian tribes and the barbarian invasion. It was not people that, we hate the Romans, we hate these people. No, they admired Roman civilization, similar to how the Romans felt about the Greeks. The barbarians felt that way about the Romans. They admired all that had been built up, but they didn't really want to destroy it. They wanted some of the wealth for themselves. Unfortunately, they didn't have the tools, they didn't have the skills to be able to maintain the civilization. So it declined, it fell. One historian likened it to a subsistence farmer that's given a tractor, but he doesn't know how to operate it. He doesn't know how to maintain it. And after a while, it becomes a piece of rusty metal. And that's kind of what was taking place. Anyway, it's a mixed bag. This is going on for a fairly long period of time. All right, now we need to move to letter C in Roman numeral 2. And who is this guy, Ulfilas? And what is Arianism? Ulfilas was a man. He was a man who was very, very significant. What had happened was during a Gothic marauding or raiding expedition back in the 200s AD, a Roman provincial family in the area of Cappadocia, in Asia Minor, was carried off by this marauding German barbarian tribe. And out of that, a generation or two later, a man was born. His name was Ulfilas. He had a Greek-speaking mother. He was, in some sense, a part of the elite, but he was raised in Gothic area. Now, he was sent down to Constantinople as a hostage. Back in those days, warring factions would trade hostages as kind of like political pawns. They'd be kind of trading their chips to gain some political advantage. And Ulfilas was sent down as a hostage to Constantinople. While he was there in the 300s AD, he became a Christian. But he became an Arian Christian. Do you remember Arianism? If you were here for part two, Persecution and Heresy in the Ancient Church, you would have heard about Arianism because it's really the chief heresy of the 4th century. Arius himself was a presbyter in Alexandria, Egypt, and he had an idea about Jesus because the question was, how are we supposed to understand Jesus Christ and God the Father? You know, what's going on here? Is Jesus God the same way the Father is God? And what happened out of that theological controversy at the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD was that it was determined then, and has ever been the case for Orthodox Christians like us, that the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit are of the same substance, the same essence, the same godness, and that we worship one God in three persons. And the Father is God, and the Son is God, and the Spirit is God, all equal in power and glory and honor. But Arius had a different view. He thought that the Father is certainly God, but the Son is a little less than God. We'll call him God with a small g. And in this regard, it would be very similar to a present-day Christian cult called the Jehovah's Witnesses, who really can't be regarded as Christians because they don't honor Jesus with a divine status. And by the way, if Jesus isn't divine, then his death for our sins is of no account. So this is a really big deal. This is the controversy that Athanasius was involved in. But Arius put forth this idea, and Arianism, well, it's on your outline, Arianism catches on, and it catches on in a big way among these Germanic barbarian tribes. Ulfilas imbibes Arian Christianity, goes back north, and becomes an apostle to the German tribes. And so they convert to Christianity, but they convert to this heretical form of Arian Christianity. Now, Ulfilas was very effective in what he did, but there's a few things that need to be said here about conversion in these ancient times. You know, we are we consider ourselves as individuals, you know, rugged individuals, and I believe what I want to believe, and you can't tell me what to believe. And we have this individualistic sense of our personal identities, but back in ancient times, they didn't think that way at all. People weren't individuals; they were part of a group. You couldn't live as an individual. You couldn't go get an apartment somewhere in some village and live in a city or something like that. If you didn't exist within a community or a tribe, you didn't exist. You didn't live. Every tribe, especially in these northern barbarian tribes, there was a chieftain, and there was an order, and you did what the chief said. And Ulfilas was successful in converting chieftains or warlords or little kings or whatever you want to call them. And then he would turn around and say, guess what, everybody? This is how we're going to think and this is what we're going to believe now. And they go, okay, sure. So the extent to which this is personal conversion in the way we would understand it is questionable. You have to keep that in mind. Also, the kind of Christianity that Ulfilas brought, this Arian Christianity, it's different than what we're seeing, you know, when we're thinking about the ancient church history and what's going on in Rome and things like that, where they actually had church buildings and stuff like that. The clergy in Arian Christianity were more like military chaplains, because these people were on the move and they were warlike. And it did have a moderating effect on their the way they lived their lives. But for the most part, these are warlike people. You know, think gladiator. Okay? They're not just peaceful farmers here. You know, it's like it's a different sort of thing. So Ulfilas is effective in converting most of the German tribes to an Arian form of Christianity. But letter D, here's the next guy, Clovis and the Franks. Clovis is of a different tribe. The Franks, from which we get the present-day place name France, was a very powerful Germanic tribe, and they were up in this more of a northern area of Europe. Clovis has a Constantine-like conversion. Now, I didn't mention this, but one of the things that turned the tide for the Christians back in the early 4th century were Constantine the Great had, supposedly, a miraculous conversion where he saw, on the eve of the Battle of Milvian Bridge, a sign. It was the sign of the cross and the words underneath it, "In this sign, conquer." And so he put the words, or the sign of the cross, on the shields of his soldiers. They went out the next day, won the battle, and according to this account, this is why Constantine championed Christianity. There's a lot of debate about just how this happened, whether this happened, etc., but that's the story. Clovis now, a couple of centuries later, has a similar, according to legend or whatever the accounts were, has a similar Constantine-type conversion to Nicene Christianity. That is Orthodox. That's Catholic, small c, the kind of Christians we are, you know, that believe in the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, one God, three persons. Clovis is converted to Nicene Christianity, and of course his entire realm along with him. Okay. And Clovis emerges as a very powerful king and is a counterweight to this Arianism. As a result, Arianism eventually is going to die out. Clovis is going to make more common cause with the Christianity in the south, and especially the popes. Clovis will have his line that follows him. It's called the Merovingian line. And then there's a little bit of a lateral shift, and there's going to be another line that develops and emerges, this other great king that you probably heard of, Charlemagne, Charles the Great. That's going to come a few centuries later, but he's going to be very significant. This is very significant in the whole church-state interaction that is really going to be, in a large part, the story of Western civilization. And we'll be getting to this in another part of church history. Okay, so you got Clovis and the Franks. And so the influx of these barbarian tribes, they do have an effect. They conquer Rome, but they're eager to adopt Roman culture. And so you have them bringing with them certain things. Some of these old gods that they worship, really coming out of the north. Odin and Thor. That's why we have Odin's Day, Wednesday. That's why we have Thor's Day, Thursday. That's why we get these things like the winter solstice somehow coming combined with Christian celebration of Christmas. And that's why December the 25th, kind of close to the winter solstice. And you probably run into, if you haven't already, run into to people who will tell you why if you celebrate Christmas on December 25th, you're really celebrating a pagan holiday. And, you know, you run into, maybe you haven't run into that, so I hope you don't. But if you Google it, you'll find all the kinds of reasons why Christians shouldn't celebrate Christmas. And don't let them spoil your Christmas. Just enjoy it. But, you know, was Jesus born on December 25th? I'd say there's at least a 1 in 365 chance that that's the case. It's not a big deal. In addition, I hope I didn't offend anybody with that, but I don't think so. In addition to that, you have other things going on. These pagan idolatries kind of start to blend and bleed into the church. The lives of the saints and martyrs begin to take on more and more of an importance. And Christianity, there's syncretism. And by that we mean we're trying to mix that which is not mixable. And it takes place more and more. So it's kind of a mixed bag. Of the barbarian invaders, as I said, most of them were incapable of maintaining the civilization that they entered. Even though they desired it, appreciated its benefits, they didn't know how to manage it. But one of the big deals was they were almost altogether illiterate. They couldn't administrate an advanced form of government. There wasn't a moneyed system as there had been in Rome. They didn't try to destroy Roman civilization, but all its beauty decayed and deteriorated in its hands. The pagan influences came into the remainders of the Roman Empire and even into the church. But during this long period, it was a long period of disintegration, the institution that did not collapse was the church, especially in the South. It had organization. There was communication between churches that took place. It had a developed and a developing theology through councils and synods. It had a history which made possible learning from the past and providing lessons for the present and hope and direction for the future. It had the same message, the gospel message. Now, I have to say that to a certain extent, the gospel of the grace was lost sight of pretty quickly after the apostolic era, but it was still there. And there was a moral law that sprang from it. So in the midst of all of this turmoil, there was an institution that provided some stability and some order. Harry Bower writes, "The church did far more than perform spiritual duties. It fed the hungry, released prisoners, resisted corruption, preserved books, and made new ones. It taught farming, carpentry, animal husbandry, conducted schools. It also prepared people for the life to come. And the chief instrument through which this took place was through monasticism." And that's what we want to talk about for a few minutes now. Monasticism. Yeah. The first name I have down there is Antony. Antony and the Egyptian hermit monks. By the way, let me make a distinction here. There were two forms of monasticism. The first one was a solitary form. It's called anchorite, like an anchor. A-N-C-H-O-R-I-T-E, anchorite. And then there was the communal form of monasticism referred to as Cenobite, C-E-N-O-B-I-T-E. Antony was the one credited with beginning anchorite monasticism, solitary. He was the original Egyptian hermit monk. The word hermit comes from the Greek word eremos, which means desert. And that's what these guys did. They went out into the desert in Egypt. Now, why did they go into the why would they go into the desert? They went into the desert to do battle with evil spiritual forces. They were really into spiritual warfare. Now, why would they do that? Well, that's what Jesus did. He was forced by the Spirit into the wilderness where he was tempted of the devil. There's another reason, too. One of the Gospels, when the evil spirit leaves a man, he goes into dry places. And then he finds that the house that he had left swept and clean, and he returns with seven more spirits more wicked than himself. Anyway, so Antony, this is a fascinating story. He was a wealthy, well-to-do person, and he heard the gospel portion preached, Jesus speaking to the rich young ruler, one thing you lack, if you would be perfect, sell all that you have, give to the poor, and come and follow me. And he was wealthy, and he did take all that he had, gave it to the poor. I think he provided for a sister who was a relative, and then he went into the desert, and he lived by himself. And this is fascinating because for some reason this guy was such a dynamic personality and such an attractive personality, attractive spirituality, that people would come out to talk to him and ask his counsel, and many people would come to him over the years, and there developed a following. But, you know, he's a solitary monk. He had a little hut, and by degrees he moved further and further away from civilization. But all of these other individual, solitary, Egyptian hermit monks would also set up their huts, maybe 100 yards from one another, but they wouldn't have anything to do with each other. How do they live? Well, they didn't eat much because they fasted for the most part. It's just, I mean, it's very interesting. One of the reasons we know so much about Antony is that the great Athanasius wrote his life story. And I don't know if I have time to maybe just tell you one little anecdote. It was really interesting. Antony lived to a great age. And during the period of controversy over Arianism, that controversy went on for decades. And Athanasius, because he stood for orthodoxy, was deposed or exiled by the emperor five different times. And as the battle went back and forth between, is Arianism going to hold sway in the empire? Is it going to be a Nicene form of Christianity? I mean, this went back and forth throughout most of the 4th century. At one point when Athanasius was exiled, he took a trip into the desert and visited Antony, and he got Antony on his side. And because public opinion was so important, all of the people, they adulated the monks as being the super spiritual Christian superstars. And Antony supported Athanasius. And when he threw his support behind Athanasius and word got out, public opinion really turned toward the Nicene form of Christianity. And Athanasius returned the favor by writing a very sweet little biography of the life of Antony, and his publication, The Life of Antony, went on to influence many other people, including Augustine. And this is a wonderful thing. Antony returned the favor by really blessing Athanasius, and what he did was he bequeathed to Athanasius his undergarments at his death. I am not kidding. Okay. Now, this is somebody who, you know, probably hadn't bathed for 50 years. But this was, you know, this was all he had, and he gave it to Athanasius. Yeah. There's another story about during the Diocletian persecution, Antony was out in the... I hope that didn't offend you, Craig. Okay, yeah. During the Diocletian persecution, when all the Christians are getting killed, Antony makes one of, I think he made maybe two trips during this whole period of time back to civilization. And Antony walks back to Alexandria basically to face off the persecutors and, you know, say, you know, here I am. And they wouldn't touch him. He apparently was quite a guy. Well, anyway, that's Antony and the Egyptian hermit monks, a little bit about him. And you know, Google him if you want to. You may find some pictures. There's one famous picture, a drawing of Antony. It's just this little bearded head with all of these demons and fiends and everything hanging on him. And if you read if you read the story of his life, you don't know whether to go, this is impossible, or could this really have happened? I mean, you kind of just find yourself kind of going back and forth. I'll get to my take on all this, by the way, at the end. You might wonder, what does he really think about all this? Pachomius, and oh, I got to say one more thing about an isolated form of monasticism, because it's another fascinating thing. Have you ever heard of the Pillar Saints? The most famous of the Pillar Saints was a guy named Simeon. Saint Simeon, the stylite. Stylite being a pillar. This guy went off by himself also, and he, over a period of many years, I think it was 20 to 30 years, he actually lived atop a pillar. He built this pillar. I think by the time he was finished with it, it got to 20 or 30 feet up there. It had a little banister, and he stayed at the top of this pillar out in the open weather, leaning on this banister for year after year after year. And there were some people that attended to him, a little bucket, and every once in a while they'd send some food up. And I think every once in a while he sent some stuff down. I'm not sure exactly. He stayed up there. And again, you're thinking, how weird is this? Well, it was pretty weird. But apparently the guy had something going for him, because people, again, would come from far and wide and would seek his advice and counsel. And he seemed to be very effective in many ways. What was motivating these people? Well, one of the things that was motivating them was, ever since the end of persecution, how can you really be zealous for Christ? Well, this was kind of a self-imposed form of martyrdom. These were people who wanted to so forsake the world and give themselves so much to the spiritual life, they wanted to make sure of their salvation. And you can wonder, did they understand anything of grace? I'm not sure. Had they come under wrong teaching? Yeah, probably for the most part. They were too influenced by the Greek thought that says material stuff is bad, spiritual stuff is good, kind of Gnostic in that sense. But they certainly did have some effect on those around them. Now let's switch from the solitary to the more communal type of monasticism, because this is what's really going to have the bigger effect. Pachomius was another Egyptian. By the way, the Egyptians are pretty interesting in that they, from earliest times, have been able to bear with the most exquisite tortures of body and soul. I mean, they are interesting. Even during these times of persecution, you can read about Egyptians that they're tough. It's very, very interesting. But anyway, to me, it's not surprising that this all kind of begins here. It's really hard to live the life of a solitary monk, however, in the climate of Europe. It's too cold. It's too wet. It doesn't work. And so they began to bind themselves together in these monastic communities. Now, obviously, what I've said so far would lead you to believe that these guys are zealous to the point where it's just way over the top. And you'd be right. I think that's certainly true. One individual helped to bring some semblance of sanity and order to the excesses of this monastic mind, and that was Benedict of Nursia. Benedict himself was apparently a very godly man, and we of course get the Benedictine order from this. But even more significant than Benedictine himself was a little book that he wrote. It's called The Rule of Saint Benedict. And what it was a order or a manual for living the monastic life. And he brought some semblance of order to this idea of monasticism. It was not so severe. It was not so austere. They had canonical hours, the seven canonical hours, where they would pray. They would read scripture. And they would also work. There would be time for leisure. There were vows associated with it, what eventually came to be vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. But in the beginning, it's even, you know, it's in print today. I have a copy of it. The Rule of Benedict is a pretty sane little manual, and there's a lot of good you can get from it. They would get up at midnight to praise the Lord, because it says in Psalm 119, "At midnight I will rise and give thee thanks." I mean, they did things like that. They also engaged in work in an industry, farming, carpentry, other types of things like this, so that monasteries developed that actually had an impact on the community around them. They were allowed to drink wine in moderation. They weren't allowed to hold any private property. All was held in common. They were supposed to be subordinate to their abbot. And some of these monasteries and the daughter monasteries that grew out of them became so significant and so influential that the abbot of a head monastery could have a whole lot more influence than a bishop. But what developed was there were this kind of a two-tiered segmentation of Christianity. There were the ordinary slugs like you and me, and then there were people who really were the special ops of Christianity, and they would be the monks, they would be the monks. If you really wanted to be serious about your faith, that's of course what Martin Luther did. He really wanted to be serious about his faith, so he joined an Augustinian monastery because he was so freaked out about things. Okay. Well, Benedict brought some degree of order, and so the Benedictine rule became very significant in the orders of monks that developed throughout the remainder of our time period here, orders like the Cartusians and the Cistercians and later on the Dominicans and the Franciscans, and they all had their little angle that they kind of were strong in, but a lot of this goes back to Benedict. One of the things that they did that was very, very important, and we'll just call it the preservation of civilization. The most important way was to keep the lamp of learning lit. There's a book written a few years ago, How the Irish Saved Civilization. I don't know if you saw it, but the Celtic form of monasticism. There was a monastery off the coast of Scotland called Iona, very famous, because the Celtic monks in the far north, they really preserved in a time of upheaval and instability, some stability, some learning. Evangelism went out. Things like hospitals or caring for the sick. All of this kind of stuff develops from monasteries. So, what's the final take on it? We're Protestants. We're not into celibacy. Although there are those that God calls to a celibate lifestyle, and that's fine. It's not many, but there are some. We understand that Jesus calls us not to be isolated from the world. When Paul says, be separate, come out from among, he doesn't say be isolated. There's a difference. We also would follow Jesus more than we would follow John the Baptist. There was one point where the disciples of John came to Jesus and said, why is it the disciples of John and the disciples of the Pharisees fast, but your disciples do not fast? And Jesus said, can the children of the bridegroom chamber fast while the bridegroom is with them? But the days will come when the bridegroom's taken away, and then they will fast. Jesus didn't condemn fasting. He approved it. He just said, you can't make a law about it. Well, there were those followers of John that thought fasting is always appropriate, should be a regular part of everything you do, and they continued to follow John, even into the book of Acts. You have people following John. We're supposed to be following Jesus and not the Pharisees. Jesus ate with sinners and publicans. He feasted, and they thought he should be fasting. Jesus turned water into wine at a what celebration? A wedding celebration. All this is, I think these are clues. I think we're supposed to be in the world. However, I would say this. Before we too quickly turn our noses up at the monastic system, I think we need to remember that the period of time in which they were operating was a time of great instability. And one of the few places where there was stability and where there could be the carrying on of things like the preservation and the copying of the scriptures and the developing of new books was in the monasteries. So it should give us a little bit of pause. Anyway, I'm just bringing this out to let you know this is a very significant event or something that eventuated out of this period of time that ended up having great impact on the church.